Today, the economy is broken. Long live the Phillips curve. Hello guys, Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Wealth Notice Post covering finance and private news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Friday afternoon, Tarek Brooker's with me. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
Pretty good. How are you going?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. It's all happening once again, and you know, it's keeping me busy.
Well, that's good. Now the question is, how many roles are you actually inhabiting at the moment? I mean, there's journalist, there's blogger, there's analyst, there's financial commentator. Yeah. Well, can you make five or six?
Oh well, you know, and then there's my actual real jobs where I, you know, where I moonlight in retail and admin as well. So.
We live in crazy times, don't we, eh? It really is hilarious on one hand, but also quite sad on another.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, but that's what it takes to make a living and, you know, do things like save for a house in this, you know, crazy messed up world that we lived in.
It certainly is. And talking about crazy messed up, well, I guess you could say that the data over the last couple of days have got people a bit confused.
They are confused, but I also don't know why they're confused. You know, like everyone's like, well, why isn't wage growth rising more? And it's like, well, because you've got this giant vacuum cleaner called the housing market sucking in capital and just breaking, you know, the sort of, you know, the normal sort of way that the economy functions, the way that capital and cash is dedicated towards the most productive return. Whereas why would you want to do that when you can just negatively gear a property in Sydney, like our Prime Minister, and make more money than the average Sydney household that did over the last decade?
Yeah, well, Dan Ziffer from the ABC did a very good article a couple of weeks ago. I'm sure you saw it, which he basically said, my house is making more money than I am.
Yeah, no, it was a fantastic article. I mean, I suggest you put it in the description. It was really, really good.
Yep.
And yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, how can we have, you know, especially, you know, our PM, someone, you know, who's sort of like meant to look after the welfare of all Australians, who buys a house in suburban Sydney. Now, we're not talking about a mansion. You know, we're not talking about something. This is like, you know, a suburban house in Marrickville and, you know, in a suburb of Sydney that's made more money than the median Sydney household did over that time, and a significant amount more too. And it just breaks my brain that no one goes, maybe this misallocation of capital is part of why wages aren't growing the way they used to.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, it's a similar trend, of course, in other places around the world too. And it's like, you know, something has changed and something has changed substantially. And if you look at it, you know, proportion of lending going to housing through the roof, how much of the assets of households are actually in housing through the roof. And as productive real economy and investment in business through the floor. That explains it, really.
Well, I think you summed it up well a couple of weeks ago when you said that they've got this lever and they pull it and they pull it and they pull it and they keep pulling it regardless of, you know, what's actually, you know, the cause and the effect. You know, we all know that at some point they're going to turn around and they're going to go, you know what we should do to help stimulate the economy and create jobs? Let's cut interest rates. And it won't work. Because it doesn't work the way that it used to, and it hasn't for quite some time, but it's not going to stop them from doing it. And that's just really, I think, just the crux of the issue here, and really the title of the show, just the fact that the settings are broken and the economy is no longer working for the everyday working person.
Yeah, and that's really the point, isn't it? Because if you look at the data, my surveys, for example, you know, real households struggling more and more, and the pressures on those households continuing to get more severe. And yet, you know, the small proportion of CEOs who've had huge wage rises and, you know, bonuses this year, look at the energy companies, you know, it's misallocation of capital left, right and centre, isn't it really?
It is, and it's a broken system. But I think one of the things that is the most fascinating about it is that anyone who can read a graph can look at, you know, the divergence in outcomes experienced by households at, you know, stagnating real per capita household outcomes at, you know, wages, you know, anemically growing despite literally closed borders and the best, most ideal conditions imaginable with hundreds of billions of dollars worth of stimulus, and it still doesn't work. It's not that hard to look at it and go, maybe we should try something different. Maybe something changed between, you know, the strong wages growth of the 1990s and the early 2000s and now. Maybe we should look at that and maybe we should try and find a way to restore that. But that's not what's happening.
No. And just to explain the whole point about the Phillips curve, it was meant to be a relationship between the economy, interest rates, jobs and wages growth, right? It's broken. It's not working.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, like, if you look at Alex Joyner from IFM did a nice little sort of Phillips curve on, you know, basically where wages would be or could be if, you know, we're experiencing a more normal economic cycle. And they'd be rocketing. You know, if you've got 3.4% unemployment, wages are going to be absolutely taking off, but they're not. They're still, you know, anemically, you know, even below the middle of the band for the RBA's inflation target. And if you compare them with actual headline inflation, let alone the new monthly headline inflation metric, it's horrible. It's really, really not good. And it's sad, really, that there's not a greater drive to address that problem.
No, that's right. A bit of lip service from the new government, but that's about all. And then, of course, they say, well, what we'll do is we'll increase migration. That'll help, won't it?
it's disturbing, you know, like, no, I mean, like, you know, my dad came here, you know, from overseas. My grandfather came here from overseas. I'm surrounded, you know, by migrants in my family, in my missus's family, you know, and migrants help to build modern Australia, you know, and I think it's really important that distinction be made that, you know, that they have made an enormous contribution to this country, you know, to make it what it is today, you know, in culturally, economically, you name it. But when you start looking at immigration for the sake of pumping GDP numbers, not having people come here and help to build the country and build a better life for themselves, when they're just put into these places with inadequate services and, you know, just things, you know, with a standard of living that in some cases, you know, Australians would take serious issue with. And I don't think that's right. You know, I think that if you come to Australia, if you've paid your dues, you know, you deserve to aspire to the same quality of life as everybody else. You know, and unfortunately, we are seeing the consequences of the government at a state and at a federal level not dedicating sufficient resources to these high growth corridors. You know, where you have these overcrowded schools and these hospitals that are stretched, and it's really sad to watch because we have all this money for all these other things, yet we don't apparently have the cash to be able to, you know, get these areas up to snuff.
No, absolutely right. And it's interesting because the Treasury, they published a paper for the summit that's in a couple of weeks, you know, which is sort of jobs and everything else, right? And then I picked out one of the real interesting clauses where they said we can attribute a GDP growth element to each migrant that's coming to the country. You know, it's multi-million dollars. I'll put it up. But, I mean, it shows you how they're thinking, right? More is bigger.
Yeah. And the ironic thing is that we've seen time and time again that it doesn't work. You know, I mean, like Shane Oliver wrote an article, I think probably a couple of years ago now, showing, you know, if I can find it, I'll get you to put it up on the screen. And it just how many recessions in per capita terms Australia had actually had over the last 30 years. You know, there's like, you know, the headline narrative of, oh, you know, Australia's great. We haven't had a recession since, you know, 1991. It's so amazing, et cetera, et cetera. This is all pre-COVID, of course. Yet, if you look at things in per capita terms, yes, we have had recessions. And not only that, but if you then compare per capita growth, even with places like Japan that have been consistently criticized for having lost decades in terms of real outcomes, in some cases, ours are worse.
Yep.
So it's not the, you know, it's not the silver bullet that politicians make it out to be.
Well, basically it's quantitative peopling, isn't it? Rather than, you know, printing more money, we'll just print more people.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, it just, you know, say for example, you bring in, you know, 260,000 migrants, hypothetically speaking, that's expanding the population by 1%. It's 1% more consumption. And, you know, it pushes up GDP by, you know, a similar-ish number. And it's just, it's lazy economics, and it's a lazy way to keep the economy out of headline recessions. But unfortunately, despite Albanese and the Labor Party blocking Morrison's target of 160,000 permanent migrants per year, now they're talking, now Labor have not only said, have not only gone from blocking that, but they're now saying, oh, we might do up to 200,000 instead. And it just beggars belief. And really, I think there needs to be a lot more discussion about this, because, you know, we've seen in multiple polls that a large number of people are not okay with this level of immigration, that they see the issues that it creates. You know, they perfectly accept normal levels of immigration, and that's fine. But they just want to let the infrastructure catch up with the amount of people that are already here. Like, the fact that we're having the issues that we're having now with the health systems, with some school systems, with all these different things, after having borders closed for 2 years, just speaks volumes about how much more time and resources are needed to bring things up to a reasonable standard in some places.
Absolutely. And of course, all the extra people drive around and create more potholes, don't they, Terry?
Yeah, they do, you know, and then the government passes the buck when something breaks. You know, it's not our fault, it's someone else's fault, and it's just ridiculous. I mean, like, I've seen it in the States, you know, I've seen it other places, and like, I've literally been to third world countries that know how to do these things better, you know. But really, you know, that's what happens when you end up with these bloated organizations with, you know, with council CEOs making seven-figure sums that rival, you know, that rival the salaries of people, you know, running ASX companies worth billions of dollars. And, you know, I guess it's not really all that surprising that this type of thing ends up happening. You know, it's some real, you know, last couple of centuries of Rome stuff.
Yeah, well, I would argue it's the fag end of capitalism, basically.
Well, I mean, I guess it is. I mean, it has more in common with sort of third world cronyism in these, you know, tin pot dictatorships, really.
That explains a few things too, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, but that's how you end up with a prime minister being half of cabinet, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, spot on. Exactly right. Well, look, we better get onto your slides, because I know you've done a lot of work on them, but I think it was good to just sort of air this critical issue, because actually this is a really, really important issue that everybody should be thinking about. And we shouldn't just be bounced into massive amounts of migration just because the government says it's a good thing, or Treasury actually more likely just says it's a good thing, because there are consequences, and those consequences will mean weaker wages growth, more pressure on all our resources, and less livable places to live in. You know, is that what we want? I wonder.
No, indeed. All right, well, we'll get started with the slideshow. And before we kick off, as usual, all the charts are available at avidcom.substack.com if you want to have a closer look, or you just want to follow along as we go through them. Also, I just want to take a moment to just say, you know, just a big thank you to all of my readers and all of the viewers here at DFA. You know, it's you guys who make this possible, and the feedback we get is just fantastic. And it's just, you know, great to be able to share this with you on a Friday. Okay. Now we've got the update for Kiwi housing prices as promised from last week. And in the yellow there, we've got the US housing crash. So I think that chart rather speaks for itself in terms, you know, Wellington has seen not so much a recovery, but a stagnation in the last month, which is somewhat interesting. But I went through the data for the region of Wellington that, as defined by the REINZ, which is the Real Estate Institute of New Zealand, and the region fell by almost 5% for the month outside of Wellington itself. So it's an interesting little statistic, something to keep an eye on, but, you know, it's not bucking the bigger, wider trend, which is negative. And frankly, you just got to compare it to the US housing crash. And it just, like, you know, you look at, say, Auckland, you know, it's falling more than twice as fast.
And it's interesting because, of course, the New Zealand put the cash rate up again, 0.5% this week. There was quite an interesting conversation from Adrian Orr at the press conference, 45 minutes, actually. It's on YouTube. It's worth listening to, because he was pretty transparent about rates are going to go higher. You know, he's thinking 4% is probably where the cash rate will get to. and he's expecting more weakness in terms of housing, but it's still maintaining housing balance sheets are in fine fettle. But it was quite interesting because he was completely au fait with the impact, but saying we've got to do it because we've got to get inflation under control. So.
Yeah, no, it's rather interesting in that regard. I just, you know, I do like the transparency that we've been seeing from some of the central bankers more recently. I think that that's been rather positive. But yeah, it's a bit of a worry, you know, just seeing, you know, how sanguine at times the Australian Reserve Bank is. You know, they could. I guess the thing is that they're just going to say it's not our remit. You know, in New Zealand, they can say, oh, yes, well, you know, we do cover housing prices. That is part of our remit. But, yeah, it's rather interesting in that regard.
Mm. And I'll just make one other point about New Zealand. They published a paper yesterday, which was a research paper between the bank and a couple of other entities in New Zealand. And basically, they were sheeting a lot of the housing problems to lack of supply again. Right, it's the same old, and it's sort of a bit of a glance towards, well, okay, low interest rates help, but actually it's really a supply issue. They still haven't understood that credit and credit availability and interest rate is the fundamental lever that actually drives housing growth and credit growth. I mean, it's so obvious, and yet everybody wants to skirt around it.
Well, that's I think the thing that you've nailed it right there, wants to skirt around it. Mm. I mean, you know, I guess it comes, you know, comes back to, do people really believe this? You know, are they, what did they call them? What did the Soviets used to call them? Useful idiots?
That's right.
You know, or, you know, did it, so did they actually believe this? Or is it something else entirely? I don't know. You know, I'm not going to pretend to know if this is just, I mean, there are true believers out there. There are people who harp away on this day after day after day, yep. You know, who believe that credit has nothing to do with it, despite the copious evidence that to the contrary. But, you know, it is what it is.
Indeed, it's just fascinating. But anyway, as you say, New Zealand continuing to decay in terms of housing prices. And everybody says, well, of course, you know, they had a massive run-up, so of course it's going to come back. But the consequences and implications of falling house values in terms of consumer confidence and people's ability to spend on the wealth effect, that's now we've probably got to watch, I think.
Well, it's going to be an interesting one. I mean, it is the bellwether in that regard. So if things keep going the rate they're going, I mean, people say, you know, people have been saying, oh, but you know, it's not that bad. And it's just like, well, yes, actually it is that bad. You know, the US housing crash is seen as, you know, this huge, big event. Yet this makes the US housing crash look like a sideshow.
Yep.
In some of these cities, you know, I mean, obviously there were places, you know, so like Miami, et cetera, which, you know, sort of took the elevator down, but, you know, in national versus national, it's not a pretty picture.
No. And of course, in New Zealand, again, there's a lot of fixed rates going to reset ahead. So it's not over, even if, you know.
No, indeed. Yep. Now I've done the same thing here with, except this is not from Peak. This is from the start of the RBA starting to raise interest rates. And I've done in that the dotted black line there is the US housing crash against Australia this time. And it just goes to show that, you know, on a national level, it's actually bang on. And I will also note that this chart isn't actually complete for the month either. This only covers up to the 19th of August, so there's still another 12 days worth. And right now, the national capital city average is roughly tracking bang on the US housing crash.
I think that's quite significant. And if bearing in mind also, there's something else to think about. Once the RBA makes a rate announcement, it takes somewhere between 6 and 8 weeks for that change to percolate through to real mortgage payments going out of people's bank accounts, because the banks have to actually communicate it to the borrower, and then they have to wait for the repayment cycle, normally monthly. So it's worth just reflecting, most people yet have not seen the impact of rate rises in probably June, July and August. You know, the May one's probably come through now, maybe June, but the other two are still coming through and we're going to see more. So in a way, it's quite interesting, starting from that point when the announcement was made. The other point is that if you actually go back a bit before that and look at Sydney, prices were actually already decaying before the RBA announced.
Yeah. No, I'm putting together a thing for an article in a couple of weeks, and it just goes to show that Sydney prices started falling in February.
Yep.
And Melbourne in March. So, you know, but it's also interesting to note just how the market the national market, I should say, has bifurcated between different places. Like Adelaide is still, you know, going along relatively nicely. It's still rising. Growth has flattened out significantly in the last few months. You know, it's gone from sort of roaring along to just being sort of not quite flat, but just very minimal rises. Yep. And it's a similar story in Perth as well. And, you know, the question is are prices going to keep rising in these places, or are they going to roll over and they're going to join the rest of them? Because this is very similar to what happened in New Zealand, because you saw Auckland and some of the other cities like Wellington roll over first. And then it took quite a long time for that to feed into the cheaper cities where they started rolling over. And I think that's what we're starting to see in Brisbane. There was an interesting little article this morning from Macro Business, which showed that prices in Brisbane for the month are now falling at very nearly the same rate as Melbourne. And I think that's somewhat interesting, considering that not too long ago, there were a lot of people saying, oh, no, this is a Sydney and Melbourne issue. It's not going to affect the rest of the country. And now it is.
Yep. Well, it's definitely spreading out. The question is how far and how fast. And, of course, units and houses are behaving a bit differently. Some of the most significant falls in and around Sydney and Melbourne are actually in the units. There is a less of a representation of units in the West, for example, and in Adelaide and Tasmania. So I think the fact that houses may be part of it, but all the research that I've seen suggests that there's a lag, but it tends to ultimately go in the same direction. And of course, in volume terms, the markets are very small relative to the large market. So in terms of future credit growth and economic impact on the broader economy, two or three of the major markets, if they go south, then it's pretty much the economy in Australia goes south.
Yeah, in aggregate terms, yeah, I would agree. Now, this is, you know, back to the title and back to the discussion we were having at the start of the show, and it just goes to show that despite the labour market being tight and despite it tightening significantly from 2014 onwards in terms of businesses reporting a constraint on output from labour, it's not translating into wages growth. And it's a similar thing across the board. You look at things like job ads, you look at things like the number of job openings versus the number of unemployed. You put all these different things together and all of these different models spit out and they go, high wages growth, but we don't have high wages growth.
And by the way, it's not just here, but it's also true in some other countries, although less in the US, the wages growth is a bit stronger then. But again, if you look carefully, it's not all industries, it's not all types of employees, it's quite selected. And in fact, part of the issue that I see is that if you look at the latest data from ABS that came out yesterday, they show quite big differences between different industry groups as to where wages growth was. Other point, of course, is that businesses are quite loath to, you know, pay over a certain level because, of course, it impacts their profits. What they want is cheap labour rather than expensive labour. And that's the other driver, hence going back to the inflation of migration. You know, if you can get more people coming in, I can pay them less and still get them. So there is this price-sensitive point from the point of business as well, I think.
I'm shocked. I'm positively shocked.
Quite unusual, really.
No, it's interesting because, you know, you mentioned that because, like, about the US is that, like, within the US, you're seeing 7% plus wage growth on paper. But what was really interesting to me is that CNN did a survey a few weeks ago, and they asked in particular the renting demographic, have you seen wages growth over the last 12 months? And despite the fact that wages growth is apparently rampant across the board, only 33%, I think it was about 33%, don't quote me on that, but it's roughly that ballpark, reported a wage rise. So you've got people seeing their rents rise by 15, 16, 17% and the cost of food going up 11, 12%. And it's like, well, no wonder consumer confidence has collapsed.
Yeah, and the same data came out from the UK this last week. You know, they had a big, bigger than expected CPI hike, and now they're thinking maybe 13% won't actually be the end of it. It could be bigger. But it was also, again, the renting sector and those in lower the income quartiles and deciles were actually being worst hit, and their wages weren't going up. So it is a very similar pattern of behaviour.
Yeah, and it just speaks volumes about, I'm not going to get too carried away here, but it speaks volumes about the issues, shall we say, with the idea of economics, of economic theory, of how it's approached by the government and just more broadly. Because it's all well and good to look at aggregate figures, but aggregate figures do not tell you the story. Because it's all well and good to go, oh, well, the average person got an 8% wage rise. Well, congratulations, yeah. Timmy on Wall Street got a 25% pay bump, you know, but Joan working as a waitress got 3% or 4%. And that's well below the 8.9% or 9% inflation that is currently being experienced in the US. And it just drives me up the wall, you know. There's an article today, you know, I believe it was in the Sydney Morning Herald, talking about how the average Australian has $40,000 worth of saving. It's just like, well, I wonder how much the median Australian has.
Exactly. Well, you and I have discussed median and average perpetually, right? It's so critical. Yeah, I mean, and I actually did an interview the other day when I was talking about this and said, in fact, it was on ABC Lawarra. I said, because it was talking about wages growth and, you know, average over the last year. And I said, well, you know, if Elon Musk came and lived in your postcode, right? The average income growth will go through the roof, but the median wouldn't move an iota.
Yeah.
Right? And that's really important to understand, right? Because effectively, you can have big distributions and you can have a small number of people with very large incomes in a postcode, and that boosts the overall postcode. And these averages are really important for people to understand, because actually, I think politicians and maybe even some journalists pick these numbers deliberately to confuse and to try and spin a particular story, rather than actually getting to the truth, which is actually that a lot of people may have buffers, but a lot of people have no buffers and no income growth, and that's where a lot of the pain is. And guess what? That aligns to things like mortgage stress and rental stress.
Well, to me, it should matter, you know. Rather than looking at those things, it should matter. It should matter what's happening to the average Australian on a median level. You know, it's frankly, it's a little bit ridiculous that it doesn't, but I'm not going to get carried away, and I should probably get on to the next slide, otherwise I'll be ranting all day. Now, this is, I think, really interesting. It's from the NAB Business Survey, and it just shows that purchase costs and even labor costs are up significantly. Now, in theory, this should translate into wages growth, but it isn't. So the only thing I can, you know, the theory that I have is that they're hiring more workers, or that they're giving people more hours, and that's why what labor costs are rising in aggregate, rather than people enjoying these huge pay rises. And I should also note that this chart is for a quarterly rate of price growth, not annual.
Yeah, and on that, again, my surveys show that there are more people with more hours now. So they actually are generating a little bit more, but the hourly rate has hardly moved up at all, even for those who've got the statutory increase and all those sorts of things. So that's the way it's being done, and in some cases it's being done with overtime rather than anything else. Of course, the point of that is that it might go the other way if momentum eases back. That could go away as well. It's not structural wage improvement.
No, and that is the problem that we face here in Australia. You know, I mean, we have we are going to basically have the same inflationary issues as most of the developed world. You know, with the obvious exception of Japan. You know, we are heading towards what they're talking about at 8% inflation. Which, considering the fact that the monthly CPI data, which was extremely preliminary, and I should say take it with a bulk carrier worth of salt, because it is a new metric, that registered 6.8% inflation in June. Yep. So realistically, we are heading, you know, based on the various forecasts and the trend, we are heading towards something around 7 to 8% inflation, perhaps more, we'll just have to wait and see. You know, there's obviously a million different factors that could affect it between now and the expected peak in December. But, you know, it just goes to show just how far behind workers and just households are falling, because, you know, we've got wages growth growing at 2.4%.
Absolutely. Well, there's never been such a big drop in real incomes, I don't think, ever in the last few years that I've been watching it. Another point to make is, of course, that ahead we know that the costs of energy, particularly electricity and gas, will go through the roof because the forward prices are still much higher than what people are paying. And whilst there's a bit of relief with regard to the petrol bowser, of course, we're having that excise relief taken away at the end of September. So wherever you look, it's going to be bumpy.
Exactly. And I would also add that the release of US strategic reserves also ends at the end of September as well. So it could be a little bit of a double whammy for Australian motorists in that regard.
Exactly.
Okay, now, well, on to real wages. Now, this is probably one of the saddest and worst charts that I've ever had, that I've ever shared. And I don't say worst as in worst put together. It's a great chart. I say worst as in just it's horrible. You know, we are looking at the worst real wages growth since the very least the early 1990s, and probably since the 1980s. We don't have directly comparable data. We've got to contrast different data sources. So I don't have a full-on 100% picture in that regard. But, I mean, real wages growth of minus 4.5% is just painful, really.
Yeah, and just to be clear for people to understand, real wages growth means adjusted for inflation. So it's actually year on year actually heading above where the net inflation would have taken us, right? Because that's the only way to think about it, because otherwise, you know, when you get a pay rise, it all goes in just covering the costs of those items that you've bought. So this is why this is such a critical story. And, you know, with the best one in the world, the RBA has been so accurate at projecting forward wages growth, haven't they?
Well, therein lies the issue. You know, I mean, I think that realistically, the sort of trough, shall we say, is probably roughly ballpark, or at least I very much hope it is, because, you know, if it's worse, it's going to be, well, it's going to be quite painful. But if you just look, I think one of the things that's interesting there is that the average between the second quarter of 2013 and the third quarter of 2021 is 0.25% real wages growth per year. So if you're talking about negative real wages growth for the next couple of years, bottoming out around, you know, sort of negative real wages growth of about 4.5%, and then you get back to real wages growth of 0.25%, you could, you know, you're talking literally about potentially sitting here with your grandchildren. You know, if you're in your 30s, you could be sitting here with a small grandchild and your wages would have finally got back to where they were before COVID.
Yeah, and just remember, these are averages for all wages, right? So again, distribution.
Correct.
Right? Distribution. That includes, you know, your bankers, your high-flying civil servants, and those, they're all in those numbers, right? As well as the healthcare workers and teachers and what have you, right? So again, you'll find that there's a massive difference between those. This masks that. My hypothesis would be that a lot of the strong wages growth will be in those more affluent areas. Always tends to be the case. So the net is that a lot of other people will be significantly worse off. And I'm not sure that we're going to see any real wages growth for many people over the next 2, 3, 4 years.
Well, you look at the wages growth at things like law firms or the big four consulting firms, and, you know, in some cases you're talking about double digits.
Yep.
You know, and if they're earning double digits, that means that someone is earning nothing, you yep. know, no real wages growth in a lot of cases. And it's just, sorry, no wages growth. And it's sad to see, really. I mean, I believe, like, you know, 21% of people on private, single, you know, employment contracts haven't seen a pay rise in well over a year.
Yep.
So, you know, and you know, there's also legions of other people on, you know, and enterprise bargaining agreements and other collective bargaining agreements who also haven't seen pay rises. So, Yeah, it's a sad state of affairs, and I wish that it was that the government would talk about it more. Like, you know, the rental crisis, for example, which, you know, they could perhaps talk about instead of just going, oh, hey, you know, let's just pull that immigration lever really, really hard.
I know. Well, the rental crisis is another very, very concerning thing. And by the way, there's a strong link between the wages growth story and the rental story, right? Because when people can't afford to get in to buy a house, they have to rent. And so when their rental is going up and their wages are not, guess what? Rental stress goes up, and we're seeing that too. So it's another part of the very important picture, which I'm afraid, again, the mainstream media and the politicians don't really want to talk about.
Well, without going off on too much of a tangent, like usual, between 2012 and I believe it was the start of the pandemic, asking rents nationally rose by about 5%, according to SQM. Since the pandemic to now, asking rents have risen by 24%. It is a huge, huge number. So we've literally had a couple of decades of the previous, you know, at the previous rate of rental inflation crammed into about 2 years.
Yep.
You know, and it's a bit ridiculous, really, you know? I mean, like, I realize that there are certain things, you know, that have precipitated this, and I've even spoken about them myself in articles. I wrote about it, one about it last weekend. But it's just a very, very sad state of affairs, and there are a lot of people struggling, and I think that they deserve to have their story told.
I agree, absolutely. Well, I've been paddling that particular barrow for a few weeks now and got a little bit of traction, but, you know, whenever I issue my mortgage stress, I always attach the rental stress alongside and say, there's a story here that you really should talk about. But it amazes me how the journalists just want to go after the mortgage stress. But a few people have started to cover it. The other interesting point on that is that, looking at my data, those in rental stress, they've got few options. Basically, they've got to find somewhere cheaper, which means moving further out, which means they're having to actually expend more costs in traveling, which means they're actually spending more on fuel. So effectively, from a financial perspective, they might find a cheaper rent, but the other costs are going up even more. So it's a lose-lose. And that is part, again, of this same problem that we've got, that effectively it's unequally spread, the pain and the pressure. It's unequally spread, unfortunately. And I don't see any change in that in the short term or even the medium term, frankly.
Yeah, well, I mean, hopefully, you know, some, you know, serendipitous set of circumstances comes to the rescue. Now, there's been a lot of talk about the US economy in recent weeks about, you know, the fact that it's in a technical recession, and that's absolutely correct. But by the same token, we're also seeing spending hold up not great, but roughly sort of flat-ish. And that's down to the fact that Americans are turning to the credit card in near record numbers. You know, you saw record numbers of new card creation and near record levels of expansion of consumer credit in a month and a month on month basis.
Yeah, and I'll add to that, buy now pay later is up in the US as well, which is another form of sort of proxy credit, right? So people are going mad trying to actually continue to feed their spending habits by getting more credit. And, of course, the financial companies in the US are very happy about that. Why? Because, of course, you are but a cash flow. As long as you go on paying and paying and paying and paying, they continue to perform well. And, in fact, the reporting round in the US showed quite strong performance from the finance sector because of this credit growth.
Yeah. And, I mean, the thing is, because Americans, as you can see there from the big red lines that occurred to the downside in the early part of 2020, a lot of Americans paid off a lot of consumer credit during that period using their stimulus checks, using their savings that they accrued because they couldn't go out and do anything. And, you know, I hate to say it, but in aggregate terms, there is a lot more scope for this to continue. Now, to what degree there is on a granular level, I don't know, because we don't actually have that data. But as long as this consumer credit growth continues at such a high rate, you're not going to see the US economy take, you know, the trip down the elevator shaft that some people have been talking about.
I was just going to say, and I was talking to somebody in the banking sector this week who's actually responsible for the consumer credit portfolios. And he said he's seeing significant growth now, and there are, it's like two ends, right? So at one end, we've got people who are financially compressed and they're having to grab more credit. But there's another group towards the upper end, the more affluent, who are still have got plenty of credit capacity and are actually quite willing and able to spend more. So again, I suspect we're going to see spending here in Australia quite a lot stronger, particularly because of that second group, which is about one third of households.
Well, that you know, once again brings us back to the title of this video. It's about how the pandemic and how things will, you know, more broadly over the last couple of years have broken the economy.
Mm.
You know, under more normal circumstances, rates would rise, monetary policy would tighten, markets would get hit, and everything would play out the same way it has, you know, a dozen times in the last century. But that's not what's happening. People are not tightening their belts as consumer confidence collapses. They're continuing to spend. You know, now, is that a psychological change? Has you know, parts of Gen Y and Gen Z turned around and go and said to themselves, you know what, I'm never going to be able to afford this lifestyle. I'm never going to be able to afford the life of my parents, you know, the lifestyle of my parents, even though I'm in a better job and I earn in a higher income percentile. So I'm just going to live the life that I want to. I'm just going to rent, or I'm just going to, you know, I'm just going to go out and spend, or I'm just going to go travel, or whatever it is. Now, the question is how widespread is that particular philosophy? Because if it is a significant factor, if there has been a paradigm shift, you know, in the broader economy, monetary policy isn't going to work the way that it used to, because people could just keep spending. So rates could have to go to the absolute moon if that is a major factor. And the truth is, we just don't know.
No. It's too early to say yet, but certainly the gossip from this particular conversation was there are still plenty of people grabbing more credit and are happily to spend it. So they're calculating that they think the consumer appetite for continued spending for the next 12 to 18 months will remain strong, even if rates go higher. So we'll see.
Well, I guess it sort of leads into what Kash Kari said last night, that basically, you know, you're going to need a recession to kill inflation. And, you know, well, by extension, spending.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, there's been a lot of commentary recently about inflation. Oh, it's rolling over. Oh, it's this. Oh, it's that. And it just, it drives me mad. Now, on the left here, we have the US core CPI, which is basically inflation with the volatile impact of things like energy and stuff pull out. So it's basically just a bit of a better metric of how inflation is actually faring, because obviously energy, you know, petrol prices, they can be very, very volatile. And currently it's been roughly flat over the last few months, and it's pretty much where it was in February, around about, it's been, you know, bouncing around in that sort of, you know, 5.9 to sort of 6.1%, and that's where five of the last seven prints have been.
And just on that, that's before Ukraine.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yep. Exactly. 100%. And the thing that I think is interesting is that currently core inflation in the US is 5.9%. Now, on the right, we have core inflation, except this is from the run-up to the financial crisis. And core inflation at the run-up to the financial crisis peaked at 2.5%. Now, so core inflation then was less than half what it is now. Back then, it really was all about energy and food prices. This time, it's not. It's about core inflation and energy and food prices. So what I've done here to sort of illustrate how sticky this type of inflation can be is the black circle is the US entering recession, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is their sort of, you know, go-to recession metric. And in the red there, we've got Lehman Brothers collapsing. Now, as you can see, it took to the middle of 2009 for core CPI to come down to even three quarters of a percent. So even the worst recession in modern US history, you know, in the last half a century, was not enough to kill this type of inflation swiftly. which begs the question, inflation, you know, core inflation is now more than double what it was then. How is it supposed to kill it with a, recession that no one is yet saying is going to be anything like 2008?
Sticky and takes a long time. And I think that lagging is really important, right? Because I don't think that the central banks around the world, since they started lifting, are actually seeing the result of their lifting coming through. Because, you know, my view is you've got to expect a lag of 12 to 18 months before you really see the results, right? So they'll probably go on lifting rates higher. But the thought that it would magically turn around, as the markets are saying, and everything's going to sort of, you know, even out, and there will be a massive, you know, the sun will come out and there will be a, you know, a lovely bright day and all the economy, you know, within a few months. I mean, I don't know what they're smoking, but I want some of that.
Oh, were you all about that stuff back in the day, mate? you're right. I mean, like, it would be, look, I understand why a soft landing and the rainbows and fairy tales and puppy dogs and unicorns are is an appealing narrative. I get that. And it would be nice to get inflation under control. You know, I don't like having my purchasing power and my real wages smashed any more than anyone else does. But, you know, there just needs to be a sense of realism. And I think the problem is everyone's just looking at these statistics, you know, saying, oh, but look, the headline CPI's come down. Yet these were the same people who not that long ago were saying, oh, you know, ignore the headline CPI, it's all energy. And now they're saying, oh, but look, it's coming down. Yes, but it's all energy. And, you know, meanwhile, you've got food prices up 12%, but who cares about poor people, right?
Yeah. And just remember, a lot of this inflation, I still think, goes right back to that loose monetary policy, low interest rates, massive debt, right, which is still sort of bubbling around. So that's another factor just to bear in mind. And I keep reminding people, the cost of that debt, both in the public sector and in the corporate sector, is going through the roof. So if you look at the most recent bonds that the Australian government issued, they were much higher than the ones a year ago. So the cost of borrowing and those huge debts is going to be a huge overhang in the story as well. And that's something else I think people are not factoring in.
I think that you make an important point there. And I think that there's a really overlooked issue that is things like mortgage-backed securities, you know, collateralized loan obligations, all these types of things, that, you know, things linked to commercial real estate, linked to corporate bonds, etc. Because for a long time, you know, since the pandemic started, you had QE, you had the Fed gobbling up all of these bonds, all of these T-bills, you know, just willy-nilly. So the demand for these other types of credit instruments that was still, you know, sort of double A rated, you know, still highly rated stuff, was quite high. But once you remove the Fed as a buyer, and not only remove the Fed as a buyer, but they start to roll off existing debts. Yep. All of a sudden, these people are going to go, well, if the US 10-year is paying X amount, why am I bothering with a mortgage-backed security that's paying a similar, that, you know, paying within the ballpark of a similar amount? I'm just going to go get some US government bonds. So the question is, as that demand for those particular credit instruments dries, you know, sort of dries up somewhat, so too the yields go up.
Yep.
So too the risks go up. So that, I think, is the real sort of threat of QT beyond the sort of usual, oh, if you remove QE, the market's going to tank narrative type stuff.
Yeah, and just to add to that, of course, a lot of the banks in Australia are still funding a proportion of their book from the international financial markets. Now, of course, they had the term funding facility, that very cheap money from the RBA. They'll have to pay that back eventually. So the costs of funding the book, you either go to deposits, and they're trying to do that, or they have to go to the markets. If they go to international markets, they're having to pay a lot more. That's one of the reasons why the margins in the banks reporting now are being compressed. And that's unusual, because normally when rates go up, you would expect margins to expand. But actually, it's not at the moment. It's going the other way. And so that's another indicator that there are things afoot that are against the normal logic that you'd expect to see.
Yeah, I concur. Now, this is an interesting little comparison of basically core inflation from different places. And it just shows that despite the fact that inflation now in Europe, because obviously it's accelerated somewhat since this OECD graph was made in within the Eurozone, it just goes to show how much of the inflation is actually driven by energy in places like France, Germany, Italy, the UK, and how much more is driven by core issues, by sort of more sticky inflation in places like the US. So, I mean, it doesn't really help the issue, let's be honest. And, you know, they're still going to have some rather sizable issues with the cost of energy and the cost of just everything rising towards the end of the year as businesses pass on the rising cost of energy. But I just think it's interesting that inflation is stickier in the US than in the EU or in the UK in relative terms.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. I wouldn't mind having a bit of a deeper dive on the energy sector because, of course, petroleum and oil is behaving differently from gas at the moment, and you know, gas and electricity in particular, but gas. And we know that many economies are highly exposed to the gas question, right? Partly because of Ukraine and partly because of the other issues there. Everyone's grabbing LNG where they can. That's why our local gas prices have gone through the roof, because the gas suppliers here are taking our gas from Australia and turning it into LNG and then exporting it. And so we're having to pay the same price as exportable LNG at the moment, which is why local power prices are high. There's a really interesting dynamic when you break it out into the different categories of energy, I think.
It is. And I think that, and I'm wondering if, as we get head towards the end of the year, if we're going to start to see that things converge more between the gas and the oil. Obviously you're not going to see oil rise to the same level as gas, because if that happens, oil is going to be $400 a barrel in Europe, you know, and that would just be insane. But there are places in the world that burn oil instead of gas for electricity. And I mean, I know it sounds rather backwards, but in some places it is a significant driver of power generation. So as we head towards the Northern Hemisphere winter, as you know, you see, you know, the rush for gas, you know, sort of come to a fever pitch and come to a peak, are we going to start to see oil prices following in sort of the start of Q4 as the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is the US oil reserves, which they've been releasing 1 million barrels a day from, comes to an end, and it hits its lowest level in the US reserves hit their lowest level in decades, and they're going to turn around and go, well, now we've got to buy more oil because we've got to restart refilling the reserves.
Well, that substitution question, which is what I was sort of getting at, I think it's a really critical one. Because that is ultimately the big question for the next few months, I think, as this all shakes out. And to the extent that you can switch from one to the other is an interesting, complex problem. Certainly in parts of Europe, they are sort of turning down the thermostat and planning for a very cold winter. It's not going to be very pleasant. Interestingly, even in Spain, they've tried to sort of turn the thermostats down. Not that Spain has any problems at the moment. They've got plenty of gas coming into Spain, but they're trying to be a good neighbour to the others in Europe. So it's messy. It's a whole messy thing. And I think the energy story is far from over yet, personally.
No, I agree. Now, this comes back to something that we talked about. I think it was back in, it was either March or April. It was a while ago now.
Yeah.
And it just shows how since then you've seen US inventories of retailers just take off. You know, you've seen, say, for example, the inventory of Walmart has risen by a third in dollar value. I mean, not in dollar value. Now, part of that is obviously inflation. It's the rising cost of goods. But it just goes to show just how much inventory is, how this backlog of orders has finally arrived and is now, you know, sort of driving these enormous inventory builds. But it's got to the point now where some retailers, if you want to return a product, they just go, no, don't worry about it. You just keep it.
Right. And so stocks are high. Expect autumn sales or spring sales, depending on whether you're in the northern or southern hemisphere, right, to try and shift stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that this is going to be a disinflationary, even mildly deflationary factor on the US goods CPI at a retail level. You know, I mean, obviously it's going to take a little while to feed in, but, you know, the question is how significant of an issue will this be, particularly if we do start to see demand come off in to a greater degree.
But one point I make is that with such high stock levels, that takes more working capital to fund it, right?
Yeah, well, exactly, which is why you've seen things like Target's earnings get smashed.
Absolutely, and that's the point I was going to make, that this is not necessarily very efficient from a point of view of a retailer, because they're having to spend a lot of money just holding stuff and then trying to sell it and then having to discount it. So the retail results could be actually quite weak, even if they manage to stoke more turnover by discounting heavily, which is a typical strategy in this sort of part of the cycle. So you'd expect more weak retail performance, particularly in the US, and I suspect in other markets too, over the next few months.
No, it's going to be interesting, because I think this sort of illustrates nicely just how just off, shall we say, some of these ideas that we see from the stock market are. Because, you know, you are going to see these factors, you know, whether it's inventories or whether it's margin compression or whether it's the rising cost of borrowing. All of these things are going to feed into corporate profits, and all these things, the longer they go on, are going to hit earnings.
Yep.
You know, like I'll give an example. Like, say, for example, like Disney, right? You know, a company everybody knows, you know, the theme parks, the movies, the everything. Now, Disney's interest bill is $1.3 billion per year. Now, while they've got, you know, tens of billions of dollars worth of revenue, once you actually drill down to their actual profits, it's actually a significant portion. Now, if we do start to see rising, you know, more rises in bond yields and those finance instruments we were just discussing a few slides ago, their earnings are going to get compressed fairly significantly if they have to start refinancing those debts at higher rates.
Yeah, well, that's why I'm a little bit skeptical of the optimism that I'm seeing from some US markets commentators at the moment, that, well, you know, the reporting for season was pretty good, so that means that the next reporting season will be pretty good. I suspect next reporting round will be much more difficult than this one. And at that point, you would expect markets to begin to sort of flip back to their negative sentiment, because at the moment, you know, the bear market bounce is pretty strong.
I'm not going to pretend to understand. It's got to that point for me. Like, it just, you know, there is a scene in The Simpsons, right? And Mr. Burns, you know, the old wealthy guy, goes to see a doctor. And it turns out that the main reason he's alive is because all these different diseases are all trying to kill him at once. And they can't kill him because they're all trying to do it at exactly the same time. And that's why he's still alive. And I feel like it's a little bit like that with markets. There is all these different things that are, you know, potential downsides. There's, you know, the energy crisis in Europe, the manufacturing slowdown in Asia, COVID zero in China, geopolitical issues, you know, EM unrest on rising costs of living. I'm not going to go on, but you get the picture.
Yep.
Let's just pretend all those don't exist and then send the market to the moon. That's how it feels sometimes.
I think that's exactly right. And it's because there's a degree of complexity, but it's also showing a massive range of opinions. So, that, you know, there are very strong commentators who are very negative, and there are some commentators who are very positive. And that massive wide range, it's probably broader than I've ever seen, actually, because people are just looking at things so far apart and so differently. So that tells me that the level of uncertainty is probably higher than it's ever been at the moment, which is why I tend to be a bit cautious.
No, I think caution is really the order of the day. It's just, you know, there are a lot of, and I also just think it's a lot of it as well is just the way that the market functions these days. You know, it's the fact that there's more derivatives, there's more, you know, shorting, there's more, all these different things, you know, gamma squeezes, you know, where, you know, all these other different things happening to the market, whereby, you know, the sort of conventional wisdom, shall we say, is things bad, market go down.
Yeah. Yeah. So the point there is with the algo traders, algo trading and the you know, fast cycle, high frequency trading, a lot of the transactions are actually not initiated by humans anymore. They're initiated by computers. And, you know, some people would say maybe 30 or 40% of all transactions on the day are just computers.
Yeah.
Which means, of course, that, well, you know, programmers have said, do X if Y or whatever, right? Or they've trained their computers to do particular things. But I think that's one of the reasons why the volatility is quite strong, because effectively every move up or down gets amplified by all the algos and then the counter trading that goes on. And if you overlay then the derivatives, which is another thing, of course, which is huge, it explains some of the weird dynamics that you see. As you say, it's not like the old markets from 20, 30 years ago.
No, and it's also just about the fact that we're, you know, there's low liquidity. You know, a lot of people just don't want to trade at the moment. They're just like, I don't know what's happening. I'm not going to buy. I'm not going to sell. I'm not going to trade. I'm just going to stay out and just see what happens. Yep. And then there's also the seasonality factor, because a lot of the people in the Northern Hemisphere, which is obviously where all most of the major world's financial centers are, they're all on holiday.
Yep.
So obviously there's even less volume. So there's even more volatility.
Right. High volatility, low volume. Watch September, October, folks. That's when we'll know what's really going on.
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch, I will say that. And we're on to the last slide of the day. I've made it a little bit shorter today. Well, actually quite a bit shorter. Okay. Yeah, we've got the collapse in Chinese local government revenue.
Yep.
Now, as a percentage of total expenditure, not revenue, but expenditure, land sales are 40% of Chinese local government expenditure. And that is an absolutely huge number, because basically the Chinese government cut a bunch of taxes at a local level, and they just said, you know what, just the housing market's doing great. We're going to get rid of all these taxes. We're going to gut this, gut that, et cetera, et cetera. And we're going to focus on land revenue. So land revenue took off, went through the roof. Now, you know, 40% of the expenditure, except now versus 2020, even 2020, land sales revenue is down 42.8% on an annualized basis. So that has blown a huge, huge hole in what is the driver of you know, government credit growth, the major driver of government credit growth in China.
Mm.
So it's going to be an interesting one.
And that means that taxes are down, right?
Yes, taxes and tax revenue is also down because of the COVID zero strategy. So they're really up the creek. And I should also just add that this doesn't include, you know, this drawdown in land sales revenue. It doesn't include the local governments who are taking their land, creating a corporate entity called a local government financing vehicle, selling the land to themselves backed by their own credit, and then spending those funds on revenue and holding the land in the hope that one day they can sell it for more. So it's actually
what could go wrong?
It's actually even messier than it looks. Yeah.
That has resonances of the global financial crisis and mortgage-backed securities, doesn't it?
It really does. And I really think that this is the elephant in the room for a lot of things. You know, you're talking about entities that spend the best part of, on paper, about sort of 3.5 trillion US dollars per year. You're talking about something that has a very similar sort of revenue basis to the sort of the normal sort of runnings of the US federal government in a traditional year prior to the pandemic. So it's a huge, huge amount of money.
Yeah.
You know, and they've just driven a truck through it, you know, in terms of these reduced land sales. So, you know, it's a mess.
Yeah, and this week China reduced one or two of the interest rates a little bit to try and give a little bit more leeway, and there were various you know, public statements about, well, you know, we want to sort of try and keep things on the even keel, and we don't mind a bit more inflation if that helps. It all sounds a little bit desperate to me.
I concur, and I don't think it's going to work. They keep cutting rates, they keep doing these things, they keep, you know, saying they're going to do stimulus and saying they're going to provide support, and then when you actually look at it, you just go, this is nothing. This is a drop in the ocean.
So it's fascinating to me that China's going in one direction and, you know, most of the Western economies are going another direction, and it's all sort of caught around the same issues, but actually the same question of leverage, of debt, of property, of how finance is connected to the real economy are the precisely the same issues. And by the way, if you look at real income growth in China and in other places, it's all going the same way, which is down. So, the bottom line is, well, almost wherever you are, if you're an ordinary person or an ordinary business, basically you're being hit over the head by a 4x2.
Yeah. Yeah. No, unfortunately, that is the case. And it's just, I mean, I think that it's interesting to see that say, like, in, you know, to once again talk about China, their youth unemployment rate is almost 20%.
Yes, correct.
You know, you're talking, you know, if you look at a chart of average Chinese youth unemployment between, say, let's say sort of, you know, when you know, the early 2000s, you're talking about 6-7% youth unemployment, rises to a sort of equilibrium of about 10 around the sort of late 2000s up until, you know, the start of the pandemic. And then it doubles. It's doubled. Yep. Or thereabouts over the last 12 or 18 months.
Yeah. Doesn't bode well, does it? And of course, whatever happens to China, economically speaking, is going to have a profound impact on Australia and the Australian economy for obvious reasons. Another reason why, again, I'm a little bit cautious about what's going to happen ahead. Tariq, very important conversation once again. Great slides. Thank you very much. We'll put the links and things below so people can get hold of their own copies. And I guess we'll circle around and talk about the sorts of things that we're talking about again in a couple of weeks' time, on the assumption that it'll be much the same, but it'll be quite different as well.
Yeah, well, there's always more to talk about, mate.
Indeed. Appreciate your effort, and thanks for talking with us today.
No worries, mate.
See you anytime. Later. Cheers. Bye.